Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we are talking about the deep connection between humans and animals. In her new book, Our Symphony with Animals, on health, empathy, and our shared destinies, today's guest, Dr. Aisha Akhtar, traveled the country to talk to people about how animals have touched them. She interviewed farmers, veterans, victims of abuse, and survivors of Hurricane Katrina. She also shares her own personal story of sexual abuse and being bullied as a child. When she was 9 years old, she got her first dog named Sylvester, and they formed an unbreakable bond. They helped each other heal. Her affection for animals followed her throughout her career and led her to examine the neurological empathy that humans have for animals. Dr. Aisha Akhtar is a neurologist, preventative medicine, and public health specialist, and she serves as the deputy director of the U.S. Army's Traumatic Brain Injury Program. Previously, she worked for the Office of Counterterrorism and Emerging Threats of the Food and Drug Administration. Her new book is called Our Symphony with Animals, and Dr. Akhtar joins us from Maryland. Hi, Dr. Akhtar. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me here.
Well, thank you so much for writing this book. You know, when I first heard about it, I thought it was going to specifically focus on animals and the new information that we're learning, because so much new information is coming out about the connection between animals and humans. And it was just so fascinating to read about how animals are helping domestic violence survivors, about how they affect homeless people, about prisoners. I just found this so interesting. How did you really tap into all of these different issues?
Well, I guess, you know, it's like you said, you mentioned a little bit about my past story. And basically what happened was I was being sexually abused by an uncle when I was a child. It started when I was 5 years old. And then when I was 9 years old, my grandparents who lived next door adopted Sylvester, a dog. And he was the first dog, first animal I ever came to know. And as you had mentioned, our bond was absolutely immense. I loved Sylvester and he loved me. Unfortunately, I learned Sylvester was also being abused by another uncle who was physically abusing him, slamming him against the walls, kicking him, beating him. And for many months, I stayed silent about Sylvester's abuse, like I stayed silent about my own. But ultimately, it was my love and my empathy for Sylvester that taught me to stand up and speak out. And I was able to end his abuse, and that led me to have the courage to end my abuse as well. So now, as you mentioned, I'm a neurologist today, and I'm looking at this connection that I had with Sylvester, and I'm wondering, how do our connections with animals, how does empathy for animals affect all of us? And so that was the inspiration behind this book. And I just, as you mentioned, I spent 5 years gathering stories and looking at the science and the medicine to really explore this issue in depth.
What was it like for you to share such a personal story about your own sexual abuse?
It was odd. To be honest, in the beginning, I wanted to share very little. And then my editors kept saying that I needed to share more and more because it was a very compelling story. So I ended up weaving my story and Sylvester's story throughout the book to the culmination, the triumph, if you will, at the end. But I'm glad I did it because I think that personal story is what can drive people to really understand how deep that connection can be with animals. And I find that a lot of readers have had their own stories that are similar to mine. Mm.
Throughout your medical career, you have worked at psychiatric hospitals, you've worked with physicians and neurologists. You write that none of them really talk about animals as a form of therapy and treatment. And you write that you even downplayed your own affection for animals to your colleagues because you were kind of embarrassed about it. You write, quote, "For a long time, scientists denied that animals were incapable of emotion end quote. Talk more about that. It was interesting to read about that. We've done a lot of shows about how in medical school, you don't take that many nutrition classes. You don't learn that much about stress. And we haven't really touched on this one, that in medical school, there's not much talk about the connection between humans and animals.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing when you think about it. You know, in 1946, the World Health Organization had stated that health was more than just the absence of disease, but it was a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being. In other words, health draws from every aspect of our lives. When you think about it, you know, how we govern ourselves, how we shelter ourselves, how we work, how we eat, how we play. Everything we do in our lives, how we live, influences our health. But medicine has overlooked one crucial influence that has existed since our beginning, which is our relationships with animals. And I saw that as a huge gap. Why have we overlooked this facet? And, you know, so this is what I wanted to do, is to explore how do our relationships with animals affect our well-being in the deepest sense of the word, you know, physically, mentally, socially, not just as individuals, but also as a society, collectively.
And we're learning so much more. You've got just so much information about how we are affected by animals. You write, animals provide steady comfort in the middle of chaos. As with human bonds, our love for animals can foster us a sense of security and well-being. That love can shield us from stress, anxiety, and depression. And I have to say, you know, after the election, this job got a lot more intense, and I felt like any time I saw a cute animal on the sidewalk, I spent more time than usual just staring at it and even trying to spend more time with it. And it kind of immediately brought my stress levels down.
Yeah, you know, I think that a lot of us feel that. There are actually studies that are showing that we can physically measure the changes that occur when we're with other animals. So, of course, this depends on us being in good relationships with animals. But if you're in a good relationship with animals, you see an animal that you enjoy, you're around a dog or a cat, for example, we can measure that your blood pressure decreases, your cardiovascular heart, your baseline rate decreases, even your cholesterol level can decrease over time. In addition, we're seeing that being with animals can boost positive neurochemicals like dopamine and oxytocin. These are chemicals that help make us feel good. And the interesting part is that we're seeing the same boosts in these neurochemicals in the animals as well. So there's a mutual benefit that's going on here.
You also write that as we bond with animals, the pain, loneliness, and fear that results from traumas are replaced with companionship, consolation, and courage. And when we have a hard time discussing ourselves with others, we often find that there's something incredibly connecting about talking about animals, and that is, it's safe.
Yeah, so this was definitely the case that I found out personally, and this is part of that strong bond I had with Sylvester the dog. You know, I couldn't explain what was going on. I didn't tell my family what was going on with me. I didn't tell anyone, not even friends, not even my two sisters who were my closest friends outside of Sylvester. But with Sylvester, I didn't have to say the words, you know. It's just his undevoted companionship, his love, just helped. Honestly, it helped me step out for a while out of that miserable part of my life and enjoy being with Sylvester, enjoy his company, enjoy the joy that he was experiencing in the world. And studies are showing that many children and adults seek animals out. In particular, we have a stronger bond with animals when we are disappointed in life, when we face cruelties and traumas. That bond with animals is even stronger during that time. And I think it's because, as I mentioned, animals don't judge us. They don't question us. They don't, you know, say maybe you're misinterpreting, you're lying, things like that. They just accept us for who we are.
You also write about child abuse cases, animals are recruited to help children candidly discuss their trauma.
Yeah, so this is a trend that's actually happening throughout the country now. The first case started in Washington, the state of Washington, where it was found that a dog who was being brought in, he was a therapy dog for a prosecutor's son, was being brought in with her when she went to the office, and the dog was making friends with the children who were there, and there were these two sisters who were being sexually abused by their father, and they were so frightened to speak in court against their father, but it was the dog who helped them to remain calm and to help them to open up about what their father was doing to them. And so in this court trial, you know, they notice how crucial a dog can be to help children open up about themselves. And this is actually happening now throughout court systems throughout the U.S. Dogs are being allowed into the court systems to help victims to talk about their experiences.
This reminds me of an amazing animal sanctuary right outside of Los Angeles called the Gentle Barn. And what they do is connect formerly abused animals with abused children. Are you familiar with the Gentle Barn?
I am. And I think that's even that shows that there's even a greater bond potential when, you know, the people feel like they're connecting with an animal who, in a way that they're helping to save that animal as the animal is saving them. As part of the book, I interviewed David Lee, who is a social worker, and he worked at one of the most notorious penal institutions in American history. It was the Ohio State Penitentiary for the Criminally Insane. And this was back in the 1970s. And this penitentiary was an undercover investigation revealed absolute brutal treatment of the prisoners who were there, the inmates. And then when it came to light, there were reforms made, and one was initiated by David Lee, in which he brought animals into the institution to help brighten up the lives of the inmates. And it was amazing the success that he had. Animals actually reached these inmates in a way that other people couldn't, and the inmates they had fewer violent outbreaks. They were able to cut their medication use by half. They had far fewer suicidal attempts when they were in the company of animals. And over time, David started bringing in animals who were in need of rescue. So they were animals who were injured, animals who were homeless. And he found these animals were reaching the inmates even more, because the inmates felt like they were caring for these animals who are in need.
And we're talking about fish and birds here in some cases, right?
Yes. Initially, it was fish and birds. It was amazing. There was this one inmate who just bonded with this tank of angelfish. And he would put his hand in the tank, and the fish would only swim up to his hand. I don't know how they knew that it was his hand, but they did. But they would only bond, swim up to his hand. And when the time came for him to be discharged, he actually refused to leave unless he could take the fish with him. Hmm. He actually refused. And, you know, the good thing was that the penitentiary allowed him to take these fish with him.
The doors of that penitentiary closed in 2004. Given the success of this program and others like it, why isn't this used more widely in prisons across the country?
Actually, I think it is.
Is it?
Yeah. So David Lee's was the first one that actually showed a measurable success with the use of animals helping to reach inmates in a way that no one else could. And that since then, there has been, we've seen much greater use of these types of programs in prisons and other similar institutions. I visited one in Indiana in which they're rescuing cats. And the cats are, again, reaching out to these inmates in a way that no one else could. The cats are giving unconditional love to these inmates. Now, remember, these are folks, many of them are murderers, are rapists, are, you know, violent people. And yet they're learning a form of empathy and gentleness by being with these animals. And I think that's really crucial because, again, the animals don't really care about the inmates' past. All they care about is, are the inmates being kind to them? Hmm. And so that's giving a lot of these folks who they think that, you know, maybe society has said that there's no redemption for them whatsoever. With the cats, they're starting to feel a sense of redemption. And that's helping to rehabilitate the inmates. And actually, it's proving to be successful in getting them back out and, you know, living good solid citizens' lives.
We've done a lot of shows about how many inmates were abused as children. And since you brought up people who are in for murder, you write in your book that many serial killers exhibit signs of hurting animals when they're children. And you decided to interview a serial killer for this book, Keith Jesperson. You've got so much interesting information about the letters that you wrote back and forth, about some of the very inappropriate things he said about you and your sexuality. Talk about why you decided to try to interview Keith Jesperson and what effect he really had on you. What did you learn from him?
Yeah, that was a different experience. In medical school, they never taught us how to, meet serial killers. So this was something new for me. The reason why, in the book, I didn't just want to explore the good parts of our relationships with animals, meaning that, when we have empathy for animals. To be complete, I needed to explore the flip side. So what happens when we suppress empathy for animals or when we lose it? So that section of the book, I decided to start with an extreme case. And, I think it's pretty well known that serial killers and like Jesperson often start out abusing animals. But what's not really known, what really hasn't really been studied, is why do they start abusing animals and how does that abuse start in the first place? So I really wanted to have a chance to explore this in depth with an individual like Jesperson. So after researching him, I reached out to him and told him what I was trying to do, which intrigued him because it was a different type of story that I was trying to give. And so we started this year-long conversation, first through letters, and then we started having weekly phone calls. Eventually, I ended up visiting him at the Oregon State Penitentiary, where he's serving life. And so Keith was an interesting guy in many ways. So he had a very brutal history. He raped and killed 8 women. Brutally, absolutely brutally. He also, caused countless abuse, countless suffering in animals. Thousands of animals he killed or abused. The surprising thing with Keith was that he also had some very poignant moments of empathy for animals, especially when he was a child. He didn't grow up. He didn't come out, he didn't start out being cruel. He actually had this innate empathy. But it was suppressed over the years by his neighboring culture, his family, his friends, especially his father. And, he recognized this in a very public way as well, which was also very surprising to me. But there was a lot of, as you mentioned, a lot of going back and forth with Keith. He played games with me. He wanted to take advantage of our situation. He tried to manipulate me to come visit him and so on. So there were some humorous moments in our relationship and then also some moments that really affected me emotionally as well. Mm.
Today we're speaking with Dr. Aisha Akhtar, a neurologist, preventive medicine, and public health specialist. She serves as the deputy director of the U.S. Army's Traumatic Brain Injury Program. And her new book is Our Symphony with Animals on Health, Empathy, and Our Shared Destinies. And if you have any questions or comments, if you'd like to share a story about your close connection with animals, if you have dealt with any trauma and you've been helped by animals, we'd love to hear from you, or just everyday depression, like so many of us, and have been really affected and comforted by even seeing a silly dog walk down the street. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Aisha, you also write about just this very interesting time we're in, where there's so much love for animals, and yet at the same time, every year more than 64 billion animals are raised and killed for food globally. Here in the United States, 1 million animals are slaughtered every single hour, as you write, largely because of increased demand for cheap animal products. Intensive animal operations have replaced most traditional farming practices worldwide. And you have such an interesting story about how you got access to slaughterhouses. You were at a conference and you presented data showing how animal agriculture causes more greenhouse gas emissions than the entire transportation sector. And you were challenged by Gene Sander, who's dean of the Oklahoma State University Center for Veterinary Health Sciences. She says, "You need to visit our farms. They're nothing like what you say." And 3 months later, you take her up on an offer to take you to farms. Talk a little bit about how that exchange went down.
Yeah, it's, you know, this was also part of what I wanted to explore, is that despite this innate empathy, I think, that we feel for animals, we can also cause immense cruelty to animals, either directly or indirectly, through our purchases. And the reason why slaughterhouses, animal, you know, experimental laboratories, fur farms, factory farms are hidden from our view is precisely because they affront our natural empathy for animals. So this is what I wanted to explore. And as Jean did invite me to visit some of her farms, some of the farms in Oklahoma, we started out with a commercial egg-laying farm that was actually a family-run farm. And this is a nice guy who invited us in. He had about 40 to 50,000 chickens being raised and bred there. And what I learned was that the farms were actually far, far worse than I had ever imagined. I mean, I've seen videos, I've seen pictures of what these farms are like, but it doesn't come close to what you would experience if you actually went and visited any of these places. All your senses, your sense of smell, your taste, your touch, the sounds, everything is telling you when you walk into one of these places that these places are wrong. It stunk. These places stunk. The noises by the thousands of animals banging in their cages, scrambling to hide, was deafening. You saw just abject terror in these animals, or in the case of some of the pigs I saw in the gestation crates, they had just gone mad. They didn't even notice us as humans walking into the facility. They've been living in these crates where they can't even turn around for their entire lives, and you know, just any kind of normal behavior is gone. And these places are just horrific. And I couldn't understand how Jean, Dr. Sander, you know, thought that this would dispel what I had read about these farms, because they were absolutely far worse than what I had read.
Can you talk about what we're learning about pigs? It's interesting because on social media, for example, you see a lot of videos of people saying, look, pigs are just as intelligent as a young child. And there's this one video going around of pigs actually putting stuffed animals in a box where the pig picks up the little stuffed animal and puts it in the box and goes back. And in some cases does it faster than a young child. And I think a lot of people in the animal rights movement, I mean, they do a lot of different things to affect people, but one is to show how smart certain animals are. So what are we learning specifically about pigs?
So we do know that pigs are incredibly intelligent. They're also incredibly emotional beings. There was one study that showed that the type of environment pigs lived in can make them pessimistic or optimistic, meaning that they can have a pessimistic or optimistic outlook on their lives depending on how they were living. There are a lot of other studies like that. There's even studies in chickens showing that they can do math and that they share food and they call to each other when there's different types of food. And I think what's important for us to realize is that, you know, these things, these capabilities have always existed in these animals. We just kind of denied it because it would make us uncomfortable to think that we are eating these animals or treating these animals in the way we do if we are, if we, you know, recognize these capabilities in these animals. But so that's the historical part of why we denied these abilities, these emotional abilities, these cognitive abilities in these animals, because it helped us feel good about what we were doing to them. But I don't think we can deny that anymore. And I will say that the videos that are showing what these animals can do, it's really crucial to re-engaging with that innate empathy that we have, because studies show that we are more likely to feel empathy for those who are more like us, those who are near us physically and those with whom we know more. So the more people get to know these animals, more people see videos of pigs doing these kinds of things, showing these emotions, showing these, you know, these their intelligence, for example, the more our empathy for these animals will grow.
Today we're speaking with Dr. Aisha Akhtar, a neurologist, preventive medicine, and public health specialist, and she's author of the new book, Our Symphony with Animals, on health, empathy, and our shared destinies. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, local public radio. If you have a perspective that you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@kalw.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, it's 1A. Stay with us here at KLW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up in about 10 minutes, we will speak with one Kaiser mental health specialist who is striking today with her colleagues in San Francisco to protest understaffing and long wait times for children's appointments. And coming up tomorrow, we will talk about labor conditions inside Amazon warehouses. Workers in Minnesota plan to strike on July 15th, the first day of Prime Day. And so we'll be talking about how workers at Amazon are treated after so many reports have come out over the past couple of years. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can send us an email, yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's show about our connections with animals, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. If you'd like to talk about a personal experience you've had with an animal, or just now that there's so much awareness being raised about how animals are treated, we'd love to hear from you. How has that changed the way that you see animals and your relationship with them? Dr. Aisha Akhtar is Deputy Director of the U.S. Army's Traumatic Brain Injury Program and author of Our Symphony with Animals on Health, Empathy, and Our Shared Destinies. Since we were talking about your experience in slaughterhouses where chickens and pigs were killed, you write that a study looking at people's willingness to eat meat found that the less we are reminded of the individuality of animals, the lesser our empathy and greater our willingness to eat them. So to further remove who animals are, we slice and dice them into pieces. What do the studies say about this?
It's the same studies that are showing how we feel empathy toward each other. The more we distance ourselves, the more we think of the other as the other, meaning whether we're talking about a different culture of people, you know, a different race of people, or other animals, the more we think of them as other, as not like us, as not, you know, beings with the capabilities of feeling the same emotions or similar emotions to us, the more likely we can suppress our empathy and the more we can justify in our minds however way we want to treat those individuals. So this extends, this is how our empathy for animals is very much linked with how we feel empathy toward each other.
Hmm. And we're also learning, we've done a few shows about this and touched on it, about how slaughterhouse workers are affected. In fact, in the 1990 book Slaughterhouse, 1997 book, Gail Eisnitz interviewed dozens of slaughterhouse workers in the United States about their experiences. And one worker said, The worst thing, worse than the physical danger, is the emotional toll. If you work in that stick pit where pigs are killed for any period of time, you develop an attitude that lets you kill things but doesn't let you care. You may look a hog in the eye that's walking around down in the blood pit with you and think, God, that really isn't a bad-looking animal. You may want to pet it. Pigs down on the kill floor have come up and nuzzled me like a puppy. But 2 minutes later, I had to kill them and beat them with a pipe.
It's so sad, isn't it? And it's so sad for the animals, of course, and also for the people who work in these places. Mm-hmm. And usually these people are people who are desperate for work, and that's why they take such work. For a long time, sociologists had noticed that when a slaughterhouse moves to town, there's a dramatic rise in arrests for crimes. And this has always been the reason for this increase has always been said to be things like, you know, the brutal treatment of the workers in slaughterhouses, which is definitely true, the dangerous nature of the work, which is also true. But one sociologist thought that maybe there's something else going on here, and she thought, what if the actual killing of sometimes hundreds to thousands of beings a day could actually affect these individuals, these people who are killing them, in ways that are causing this rise in crime rates. So she looked at 600 counties in the U.S., and she compared the counties with slaughterhouses with counties which had other industries that were similar in the dangerous nature of the work and the way the workers were treated. But the difference was that these other industries did not involve the killing of animals. And what she found just supported her theory in that when a slaughterhouse, for example, of that employs 175 workers, doubled the crime rate in the county. And this was especially the case for crimes associated with domestic violence and child abuse. The steel industry, on the other hand, was associated with a decrease in crime rates, especially towards women and children, which was really surprising. So her study, this is Dr. Fitzgerald's study, was the first of its kind to really suggest that killing animals, killing thousands of beings, can affect us in ways, each of us in ways, that that can decrease our empathy and cause more widespread societal effects. In other words, killing animals causes that violence in the slaughterhouse seeps out into the larger society.
You know, and you're reminding me, Dr. Akhtar, that we do so many shows about farm workers, and that gets a lot of attention, especially in the independent media, but we just don't do that many shows about slaughterhouse workers. And so I'm definitely going to add that to my list, because like farm workers, slaughterhouse workers also tend to be mostly immigrants.
That's true. Immigrants or other minorities, just people, who, as I mentioned, are just desperate for work. And they have to use these mental defense mechanisms in order to cause the violence that they do in the laboratory. In the slaughterhouses, and to hurt these animals in the way that they do, which has negative repercussions for them as well. It causes studies have shown that slaughterhouse workers have high rates of alcohol and drug addiction, high rates of crimes, domestic violence, gang violence, things like that. So the violence that these individuals are inflicting on animals does affect their own well-being as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Cynthia, who has a question about dementia. Hi, Cynthia. Welcome to the show.
Yes. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for this program. I'm calling as the sole caregiver for my sole family member who has now passed away, who it was medically advised to me that I put her into a skilled nursing home, and I was very reluctant to do so. And so I took a tour of this facility, and what changed my mind about finally placing her, although I knew it was time, was that the facility had a farm on site. And they had pigs and roosters and goats that were absolutely wonderful, and cats, and all sorts of wonder. They had turkeys, and it was really terrific, and that's what changed my mind. I was later a volunteer, and when I went through training, most of the people in the training wanted to work at the farm, which I thought was interesting. But my sister was placed in the dementia ward. She was very young. And I saw the effect of both rescue animals and animals from the facility, how these animals, the effect these animals had on patients with dementia. And they would perk up, and the animals were like very calm with these patients. They seemed to sense that they needed, you know, to be still and calm, and they'd be trained to sit on laps of people in wheelchairs. And most of the time, the people with dementia would just perk up and respond. And what I wanted to ask your guest is she aware of any studies of animals on patients with dementia?
Hi, thanks for that question, and I'm so sorry to have heard about your sister being in, you know, having dementia. I can't imagine how hard that is to go through. Having animals in places like this, in nursing homes, in hospitals, even in airports, has actually been studied quite a bit, and there are always more studies going on. There have been some studies with dementia that suggest not that animals can reverse dementia or affect the dementia itself, but that animals can help re-engage people with dementia and other mental problems as well. Animals can re-engage them in a way that humans cannot. And I think it gets back to the fact that when we are with animals, we kind of retreat into a simpler way of being with another. You know, we don't need human language, which can be very complex and have a lot of subtleties. We communicate in a different way with other animals, and I believe that's why animals can affect so many patients who have dementia and other mental illnesses, because they don't need that cognitive side to be as strong. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for the call, Cynthia, and thank you so much for sharing your story. I should say, as one caregiver to another, I know exactly what you've gone through. So thank you so much for calling in and sharing that. Before we let you go, Dr. Akhtar, we have a few high school students in our studio today. And one of the students, Hannah, wants to ask you, why is it easy for people to feel empathy for some animals but not others?
Sure. So, hi, Hannah. Thanks for the question. It really goes back to how much we know the animals. We know cats and dogs. We especially know dogs. Traditionally, dogs have been the family pet. So because of that, we know who they are. We know that they respond to us. We know that they're emotional beings. There's no question that they feel pain and that they can suffer and that they can feel joy. So our empathy is very strong for dogs, and now it's growing for cats too, because we're becoming more familiar as a country with cats. It really only comes down to largely who we know. And that's the same with empathy towards each other. So that's why people are more likely to feel empathy towards their immediate family than towards strangers. It's because we know our family members, we're around them. So that's why it's so key to show people what these other animals are like. And that's why I think these videos, these YouTube videos showing pigs doing remarkable things, showing turkeys, you know, doing remarkable things, showing rats chuckling when they're being tickled, and showing mice showing empathy for each other. These things are really important. It's important for us to see this because it helps us to get to know these animals. The more we know them, the more familiar they are to us, the more empathy we will feel for them.
Dr. Aisha Akhtar is a neurologist, preventive medicine, and public health specialist. She is deputy director of the U.S. Army's Traumatic Brain Injury Program, and she's author of the new book, Our Symphony with Animals, on health, empathy, and our shared destinies. Dr. Akhtar, thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for writing this great book.
Thank you so much, Rose, for having me here.
Thank you. You can find more information about Dr. Akhtar's work and her book at yourcallradio.org. And coming up in just a minute, We will be joined by a Kaiser therapist who is on strike today with colleagues. They are demanding that Kaiser hire more therapists and psychiatrists because wait times for children who need therapists is up to a month or maybe longer. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.